I come from where all the real alcoholics come from. Better believe it. I hope you all know the difference between an Irish alcoholic and every other kind of an alcoholic. It's very simple, but you need to know the difference. You know, when we become alcoholics, we all become bullshitters. Well, an Irishman doesn't have to wait to become an alcoholic to become a bullshitter. We're to the manor born. We have been born that way. I go back to Ireland once in a while, not very often, just to see if it's still there and to brush up on my brogue. I was over there the year before last, and there was a story going the rounds while I was there about an American who had been on vacation there. This guy was from Texas, and he got in with an Irish farmer, and he asked the farmer to show him around his little farm, and he did. And when the Texan saw it, he said, you know, back in Texas, where I come, you don't call it a farm, you call it a ranch. To give you an idea of the size of it, he said, if I got up at sunrise and got into my car to go around my ranch, by the time the sun would have set, I wouldn't have gotten halfway around. And the Irish guy looked at him and he said, gee, he said, is that a fact? You know, he said, I had a car like that once, too. Well, I don't know whether it was the same guy or not, but there was another American, and maybe it was another one. You know, lots of Americans go over there to Ireland, and they want to see who their forebears were and all that sort. That's very inadvisable. If you ever do go, don't try to find out who your forebears were. Don't. They were probably sheep stealers or something. But this particular guy, he had came to the end of his vacation, and he was at a dance in a little village hall. And he had his eye on one particular girl there, and eventually he cornered her, and he managed to have a dance with her. And he spun her a cock and the bull story, you see, that he was leaving the next day, and he felt in his bones he would never ever see Ireland again. And he had only one regret. He never got round to kissing the Blarney Stone. Now, if you don't know about the Blarney Stone, you need to know that if you kiss the Blarney Stone in Ireland, you'll have luck for the rest of your life. So that was his regret. Never got around. So he said to her, but I believe, he said, the next best thing to kissing the Blarney Stone is to kiss someone who has kissed it. So, of course, he popped the $1 million question. Honey, have you ever kissed the Blarney Stone? She's dancing around there with him and looking up at him and saying, no, she said. But I sat on it, she said. Anyway, that's what they're all like over there. B.S.ers. Well, that's where I was born a long time ago, and I better hurry up and tell you my story. I was born in a little village in the south of Ireland where everybody was a Roman Catholic because there was nothing else to be. And I went to the school that everyone went to. First school I went to was run by the nuns. Then I went to the next school you go to, and that was run by the religious brothers. And then there was what they called the classical school, where you could learn all kinds of languages and all sorts of stuff. And that was run by the priests. So as you can imagine, when I was growing up, I heard an awful lot about God. God, God. God, did I ever. God used to haunt me. He was more real to me than people I could see with my two eyes. Now, when I get to tell you my story, I'm looking back at myself now from the vantage point of being a number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do seriously believe that I have been restored a little bit to sanity, or maybe endowed with sanity for the first time in my life. I don't know. But as I look back at myself, even to myself as I was as a child, there's no doubt in my mind now that I was born nuts. I was nuts before ever I thought of drinking. I believe that about myself now. Now, as I tell my story, it may appear to you that, oh, not at all. No, you were perfectly normal. And if that's the way it appears to you, well, keep coming back. But I have to tell you that because it's a weird story. And the more I tell it, the more weird it gets. As I say, I was not a normal child in my own estimation anyway. And there are various kinds of nuts, you know that. There are various kinds of nuts. And the particular kind of nut that I believe now that I was a religious nut. At least that's what I think now. Because I did things that I know that normal kids just don't do. They don't. For instance, the little village we lived in, the church, Catholic church, was always open. And the kids would do what all kids do. They'd be playing in their free time and all that. Where do you think I was? I was always in the church. And I don't know why to this hour, I don't know. I remember I used to, you know, they have candelabras in there in the church, Catholic churches, for lighting candles to statues. I'd light all the candles. I'd spend my time praying. What the hell I was praying about, I don't know. That's not normal. I don't ever remember deciding to become what I eventually became and still am, a priest. I don't ever remember deciding that. As far, far back as I can go with my memory, I intended to be a priest. No one ever suggested it to me. No one in any way influenced me. I always intended that. And as I was growing up, if you had asked me why, I wouldn't have wanted to tell you. Because it would have involved telling you something about what was going on inside me that I felt very sensitive about, didn't want to talk about. You see, I do remember in school one day in class, the question came up, what is the biggest thing a human being can do with his or her life? What is the biggest thing you can do? What does achievement or success, what is the highest achievement or success a human being can achieve? And there were all kinds of answers suggested. And then I remember the answer given. The answer is in the good book. What is the first and the greatest of all the commandments? What is the supreme value? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, thy whole soul, thy whole mind, thy whole strength. Do that. You've done the biggest thing a human being can do. Bigger than getting to the moon and back. Bigger than finding the cure for cancer. Bigger than making a billion. You know, I heard that just once as a child. And it went in there, and it percolated away down to my very guts. And it's down there still to this day. I believe that. I don't know why. But that idea simply gripped me. And from as far back as I can remember, I decided that that's what I was going to do with my life. I was going to love God with total and absolute perfection, with the fullest of the potential for loving that I was capable of. And if you'd ask me, well, what exactly do you have to do in order to love God perfectly? What do you have to do? Well, I would have had to say, now don't forget I was nuts. I would have had to say, well, the first thing you have to do if you want to love God perfectly is you have to make yourself as miserable as you can possibly make yourself. That's step one. You got to give up all kinds of enjoyments. You got to afflict yourself, deny yourself, be self-sacrificing, do penance, deprive yourself, renounce this, renounce that. And I said, okay, well, if that's what you have to do, that's the price. Okay. The payoff is worth it. That's what I'm going to do. And then I heard somewhere or other that if you really want to go in for an honors course in this business of loving God perfectly, well, then you have to leave home, leave your family, leave possessions and lands, and go way out to convert the heathen. And I said to my little self, now where's the most heathen spot on all this planet? Now, don't forget I was educated in the south of Ireland. Of course, it's obvious. England, of course, where else? And so, at the ripe old age of 15, I packed my little bag. I'd heard about a big monastery over in the north of England, and there was a school, a prep school, attached to that monastery. And if you wanted to enter that monastery, you went to that prep school first, and so that's what I did. And my poor father, God rest him, scratching his head and shaking his head, said, well, if you must, you must. He brought me up to Dublin, the capital of Ireland, put me on the little ship that goes across from Dublin over to Liverpool, across the Irish Sea, and I made my way there to that prep school on the Yorkshire Moors, and eventually I entered the monastery. I became a monk. In the course of time, as well as being a monk, I was ordained a priest, and I lived the life of those monks for 30 years. And for many of those years, before I started drinking, I'll come to that right now, don't worry, I'm getting around to it. For many of those years, I enjoyed that life because it was what I wanted. You know, every time I read that sentence in the big book, I say, how true. We made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. It's just what I wanted. I always thought that if you get what you want, you're going to be happy. Anyway, it was a very, very austere life. We used to fast 3 days a week. We used to get up in the middle of the night to sing the praises of God. And if you want to know what the heck God wanted his praises sung for at 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know, but it seemed a good idea to me at the time. We used to do an awful lot of studying and praying and meditating. We took the three vows that make a monk a monk. A monk, by the way, is a kind of a male nun, if you could imagine such a thing. The three vows, the vow of poverty, we undertook not to own any money or any possessions to call our own, so that we wouldn't get attached to anything. The vow of obedience, in which we undertook never to do our own will, but to regard the will of the superior as the will of God. And the vow of chastity, we undertook to renounce all that had to do with marriage and romance and sex and all that lovely side of life. The purpose of that was to have God himself have a meaning for us that was the same as the meaning that a happily married man has for his partner. It's the same idea. To love God with your whole heart. Give all your love to God alone. And the whole idea, anyway, of the whole life was to smash ego. You know the way the big book talks about smashing ego? You want to get close to God, you've got to stop wanting what you want and stop being attached to anything. You want God to get close to you, got to smash ego. And that was their way of doing it. And I enjoyed that severe life until, after I'd been ordained a priest, by which time I was, that was in 1945. Now, 5 years after that, when I was 30 years of age, I was sent to Rome to study. To study in a Roman university, right under the Pope's nose, to study all kinds of highfalutin stuff that, ordinary slobs like you wouldn't understand. Awful rarefied spirituality and stuff. And I found myself living in this big, big monastery that was the headquarters of the religious order I belonged to, this big monastery in Rome. And in this monastery, life was conducted the way that Italians live. Now, we used to have to go to the... We went to the big dining hall of this monastery. By the way, there was an enormous number in this place. There was the resident community, who were all Italians. And then there were monks from all over the world who, like myself, were just living there but attending various universities in Rome. So it was a big community of over 200. Well, twice a day we all assembled in the big dining hall. You don't call it a dining room in a monastery, you call it a refectory. And there were these wooden tables all around, bare wooden tables. And you always sat at the same place with the same monk either side of you according to your seniority. But all down the middle of the tables were these enormous flagons of wine. Big ones. That they used to position one between each two monks. They'd put them out there the same way that you'd put out a big jug of water on a table. You weren't supposed to drink the whole thing, you know. That's the way they did it. Now, up to this point in my life, I had never experienced intoxication. That's a big word for getting drunk. I'd never experienced that. No idea what it was at all. And so here I was now twice a day with two enormous flagons of wine literally within arm's reach of me. The guy who sat this side of me was supposed to share this flagon here with me. He just used to take that much in the bottom of a glass. The guy this side of me, who was supposed to share that one there with the guy the far side of him, this fella never took any at all. He was weird. Not normal. And the guy the far side of him only took that a much. So, well, my stomach was always very, very empty at mealtime. I'd come back from school very, very, very thirsty. and hungry. And by the time the meal would have ended, those two flagons of wine were empty, and I was smashed. Delightfully, gloriously, hilariously smashed. No one ever told me before what it's like getting smashed. No one had ever told me. And I want to tell you, if there's anyone here who doesn't know, it is fantastic. My Lord. It was like discovering a whole new dimension of reality. I know what Alice in Wonderland felt like when she blundered into Wonderland in the wood. My Lord. Everything became funny, funny, funny. Everything. We used to have to eat our meals, monks, in dead silence. And away down that big, big room, the big refectory, there was a kind of a pulpit. And to be a holy monk there, reading very holy, holy stuff. And when I'd get smashed, it seemed to me so funny. And I started barraging them and contradicting them. And they were nudging me, said, shut up, shut up, shut up. This was my introduction to alcohol. I really, really don't know where to find the words to say what this stuff meant to me. Really, it was wonderful. My honeymoon with alcohol, I don't remember much of it. As I say, we had two meals a day in that big room. So I was smashed twice a day. Really, literally smashed. After the meal in the middle of the day, I used to go for siesta, sleep that one off. After the meal at night, off to bed and sleep that one off. And then there were a whole crowd of English-speaking young monks like myself from different parts of the world. They're like from America, Australia, Canada, God knows where. And we English ones used to club together because we were surrounded with all these barbarians, you know, talking Italian and Spanish and German and French. Oh, God, couldn't make any sense out of these people. And we were far from home. And so we had to cheer ourselves up in the midst of this barbarism there. And we had money from our superiors back home to buy books and do deep research in the university and so on. But we didn't need all the money for that, you see. So we laid in what was necessary for cheering ourselves up. And wouldn't you know, they made my room the bar. By the way, in a monastery, you don't live in a room, you live in a cell. Some of you may have experience of that, I don't know. But anyway, I found myself laying in shelves, doing all this very secretly, laying in shelves, extra shelves into my cell, and here I had literally rows of bottles of the good stuff in my room. And my job was to have the glasses at the ready so that whenever a party was declared, everything was laid on. Now, we introduced one single Italian into our special circle. His family owned a winery outside of Rome. And I lived to see the day when we secreted a whole barrel of wine up the back stairs, along the cloister, and into my cell. And there it was put up on a trestle with a faucet on it. I was all set up. No man who ever started drinking fell on his feet like I did. I was 3 years supposed to be living the life of a holy monk and at the same time studying all kinds of holy, holy, holy stuff. And I don't remember very much of it. I did a lot of study in my room. I very seldom went. I did go out just once or twice. I remember seeing the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church there in the middle of Rome, you know, St. Peter's with the big dome and the colonnade. I saw it from a distance. When I thought it was a carousel when I saw it. It seemed to be going around all the time. I didn't see much of Rome. But all that came to an end. I got whatever degrees they sent me out there to get. And I came home to my monastery and was appointed to teach. And then I made a discovery. I had become dependent on you know what. I couldn't function at all without it. And so I have to begin a period of my life now to tell you about a period of my life that's the most boring that you could imagine. Because I became a closet drinker. I always had my bottles secreted. I switched to whiskey when I came back to my monastery. And no doubt you'll be wondering how in the world a monk living in the circumstances I've just described to you, with a vow of poverty, no money to call his own, a vow of obedience, where all his comings and goings are under the vigilance of a superior. How can a guy living in a setup like that have his constant private supply of booze? Well, all I can tell you is, I learned to live a day at a time long before I ever met you lot. You see, these monks used to go out of the monastery regularly to work. And the kind of work that these guys did, it's not very common nowadays, but you know that there's a Catholic church in, I suppose there's a Catholic church here in Greeley, is there? And a priest or two running the thing there. Now in the old days, those kind of priests running a Catholic church in a parish, in a town, would apply to the kind of monastery that I lived in for one or two of those monks to come to the parish for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever to give what they used to call a parish mission. And in the old days, the Catholic people would crowd into the church and these holy, holy monks would preach to them about God's mind and God's heart and how to be real, good Christians, how to be surrender to God's will and all that good stuff. And they were looked on, if you could imagine the way it was when Moses was up on the mountain, wrapped up with God, looking into God's mind and God's heart, and then coming down to the plains to make God's mind and God's heart known to God's people. This is the way these holy, holy monks, prayerful monks, contemplatives were looked at. And in the same way they'd go to the convents of nuns and people like that to give retreats and to make them totally, totally surrender to God, to love God perfectly and to be instruments of his love for others. Well, I'd be sent out on those kind of chores along with the rest of the guys, you see. And the pastor would notice, oh boy, he when he's full of the Spirit, my God, he's good, he's great. And so he'd make sure I was full of the Spirit. And he would give me some of it to take back home with me to my monastery.